For I begin, well, thanks for the introduction. Thanks for the group here that invites me out once a year. It helps me get back to visit my parent-in-laws. Tonight's talk, as I planned it, also involves some meditation. And I wanted to check how many of us are brand new to meditation, i.e. never meditated before. Is there anybody in that category? Are you interested in meditation?
I am.
Okay. And then anybody who's sort of dabbled for a little bit, but not a whole lot? Okay. So a couple of those. All right. Then let's start with a foundation type meditation, which is my own bread and butter. It's based in breathing, and we'll do that 10 minutes or maybe a little more. And then I'll begin the talk, or might be better to call it a presentation, because woven in it will be three meditative segments of 5-10 minutes each. So instead of just talk, part of that will be guided practices where I try to guide you into certain meditative practices, which will be of, let's say, increasing depth or challenge. And at least one of them would be considered a very advanced practice. However, I'm a believer, after teaching this stuff for 30 years, that nothing is so advanced that a beginner can't try it. It's not like you've got to go to kindergarten before you go to high school, before you get a PhD. There's things that even when you're pretty new, you can try it and sometimes get a flavor of it and sometimes get a more solid hit with it. One of the advantages of more experience in ongoing practice, the taste stretches out and you're better at staying with it and integrating it. But unlike the institutional learning that's common in the modern era, where we go to schools with grades, tests, and all that stuff, not to mention the industries and bureaucracies that dominate parts of it, or profiteer from parts of it. I'm not a fan of that part. Contemplative practice, whether Buddhist or forms of contemplative prayer in Christianity, or even pagan stuff, even sort of advanced things, is in a way accessible to everyone. And sometimes, you know, it's not presented that way for different reasons, including the egos of the teachers or of the students. There's this thing, you know, the inner group gets the real stuff. And I believe that that's really foreign to the Buddha's teaching. I actually think it's foreign to genuine spiritual practice, but that sort of thing shows up. So I will offer a few things that may seem difficult at first, and that'll be towards the end. But I really encourage you to be open and give it a try, partly as this unfolds and we get into the theme of the topic, is there a mind here? you'll kind of, these practices will be part of the response to the question. Rather than just theory, the practices create some experiential space, which in a way, this is the sneak preview, if you jump into an experience of mind, it's interesting. And that's what these practices are really for. Not quite a jump, there will be sort of stages. You jump in knee deep, waist deep, and then we're going to jump in. Maybe not all the way. We could do that though if you really want. There's some real cool stuff, and one needs to be a little careful because the standard ego we walk around in can get freaked out. But once you've sampled some of the territory and we learn to let the usual ego business relax, it's fascinating. And, you know, it kind of turns the world upside down sometimes, and that's why the ego has a rough time. It likes the world upside right, even if, in fact, the world's not that way. It just believes it's that way because we put so much energy into trying to set it up and maintain it certain ways. I hope that's not too radical or weird or anything, but that's what I showed up with this year. And in fact, the last few months and the month ahead, pretty much wherever I'm going, this is what I'm going to be doing. It's kind of my theme for the year. Okay. So let's start with what is perhaps, and I say perhaps, but from the foundation of the earliest Buddhist teachings, I'm going to present the basis of what I believe is the most foundation practice of the earliest level of Buddhism. And it remains very important in Zen practice in China. Teachers like Thich Nhat Hanh from Vietnam, China, India, places like Thailand, especially the forest tradition, which was where I practiced, studied, and trained. It's called mindfulness with breathing. So if you like, it's helpful to sit with your feet flat on the floor, as upright as your chairs allow, but not stiff, rigid upright. But sit, feel your butt in the chair, head up, but not holding yourself up with muscles that gets tired. Just feel a kind of energy in yourself that lifts a little bit rather than droops. You can put your hands in your laps or on the thighs, anything comfy. And for a minute, I want to make sure this it is recording. For a minute, just feel your body sitting here. Feel the feet soften into the floor. Let your shoulders soften, relax. Let your waistline relax. Nobody's looking. You don't have to hold your tummy in. Let the face and jaw relax. Imagine your head floating on your neck and shoulders. Kind of light rather than burdened or busy with thought. And now, please take a deep, full inhalation, breathing in and down, down towards the belly, even down into the hips. Don't force it, but breathe as full as you can without straining. And then release. Let the air flow out without hurry, without pushing. After the exhalation finishes, take another deep, full breath, a little bit intentional and strong. And once it's comfortably full, wait for the exhalation and feel it as it releases. Take one more deep, full breath. And then allow it to release. And now carry on breathing. Letting the exhalations release comfortably without hurry. And with the inhalations, simply be open, receptive. You don't have to do it. Just pay attention, feel, be sensitive and open to the natural living experience of breathing in, breathing out, one breath at a time. relaxing and releasing with the exhalations, open to the inhalations. And if you notice any attempts to control, simply relax that tendency. Ease up. You don't need to control the breathing. In fact, you don't know how to do it, and the breathing is already professional and expert. Simply let the breathing do its job and enjoy the ride. If you like, continue feeling the breath as the talk begins. I recommend opening your eyes. And I'll introduce today's theme. Chosen the topic, is there a mind in here? Quite carefully and also playfully. I want to begin by noting the term the mind. This term has been leaping out of Buddhist articles and books, both print and digital. I keep seeing this term, the mind, and it's become a real head scratcher for me, because if we really ponder it, it's full of contradictions. In terms of Buddha's teaching. And yet, I keep finding these ostensibly Buddhist teachers who like to talk about the mind, as if there's this thing, the, which implies one, mind. The more I ponder this in light of Buddha's teachings, I wonder what's going on. I have some ideas. Other parts of Buddha's teaching give strong clues about what might be going on. And as somebody committed to especially the early strata of Buddha's teachings, which are very concerned with the reality of mind, and also critique notions like the mind. Although I have to be careful in Thai, for example, a language which many Buddhist teachings occur in that culture, or the earlier scriptural language of Theravada Buddhism, Pali, which is from India, it's considered a Middle Indo-Aryan language, which means it goes back about 2,000 something years ago, and its heyday was from then to 1,000 something years ago. That's middle. It's not a modern Indian language. Nor is it the oldest forms of Sanskrit, which go back nobody knows how far. But it's hard to trace because those were oral. And they weren't written down till after the Buddha's time, actually. They're passed on by oral tradition. Anyway, in Thai and Pali, there aren't definite articles. English is a noun-heavy language. The Anglo-Saxon world seems to like things. The Germans have, anybody speak German? I won't pronounce this right. Ding, the thing in itself? Or ding, I forget it. I used to read Heidegger, but that's a long time ago. Thing in itself. You know, thing in itself, it sounds like there's a thing, a real thing, you know. And we have indefinite articles, and, you know, definite, that sounds like, you know, there's a thing, and it's not only a thing, it's the thing. And in modern English, we say the thing. You know, plus when we're being inarticulate, everything's a thing. Could you give me the thing over there? And it's, you know, people, we guess what thing of the, you know, what little bit of the universe is being referred to. I should also mention that the early level of Buddhism is full of wordplay. Much scholarship forgets this because scholarship gets too serious. And Orthodox Buddhists are too serious as well. But there's many, many clues that the Buddha liked to play with words. And I think one of the words most in need of play is mind. And even more so, the mind. So I want to draw attention to this. Notice I didn't explain, I just danced around it. Later I'll make a little bit of an attempt to explain. But I don't want to turn this into a theoretical thing. But I want to take the title, Is There a Mind in Here? Again, the sort of articles, books I was referring to where the word the mind shows up. It seems most of those writers and speakers, they meditate. American Buddhism is big on meditation. I think it's great stuff. So when we speak of the mind, we're usually talking about something in here. It's not primarily something explained by neuroscience or psychology, which talk about mind or the mind from outside. The meditative contemplative approach, that is the Buddhist approach, is to come at it from experience. But guess what? That's tricky. A trickiness that was recognized in the early years of modern psychology. Some of the first German psychologists, like in the 1860s, they started to be troubled that, unlike chemistry and physics, where you could do objective study, here we are all talking about mind, psychology, psyche. And by the word psyche is actually a better translation of the Buddhist word than mind. Heart's okay too, but psyche is, I think, even better. But we're not used to it anymore. It's kind of airy-fairy, certain groups use it. Mind is okay, heart is okay, consciousness. I kind of like awareness. Psyche is pretty good. Anyway, these psychologists were frustrated that psychology couldn't have an objective footing like chemistry and physics. So they tried to go about that. So eventually, mind was investigated from outside, which is supposedly objective. This isn't the time to critique that whole project, so I won't. But I'll just say that in contemplative traditions, we come at it from the side of experience, which means mind or awareness is the tool for exploring mind or awareness. The Buddha and contemplatives over the couple millennia that we have some record of this aren't bothered by this fact. In fact, we tend to think it's the way it should be, that mind exploring mind, awareness exploring awareness, is direct. And to come at it from outside requires equipment. Nowadays, MRIs are expensive, they've always been expensive. The prices come down a bit, but it's very expensive. Whereas you can just go out under a tree in your backyard or sit in your Boca lounger or whatever, and it's all it takes. No money, no fancy labs, let alone NIH grants. The MRI stuff, there's some school stuff being done. In fact, in Wisconsin, Richard Davidson, who's a meditator, but I want to come at this from inside and acknowledge the kind of trickiness that we'll be facing when mind explores mind, awareness explores awareness, which has been recognized all along by Buddhist tradition, that the dilemma of awareness being aware of itself being aware. And I could keep saying that and just do endless loops of mind, being mindful of mind, being mindful of mind, being mindful of mind. And yet, is there really any way to do it? It's now popular to use neuroscience. Neuroscience is now kind of, it seems to me it's the, that in certain genetics are just the sexiest priesthood these days. And we forget that none of it is direct experience. It's all very complex inference, filtered through computers, which means algorithms and software written by human minds. You know, and there's stuff about artificial intelligence, but guess who? What will program those? Maybe someday we'll be gone and the artificial silicon-based stuff will be carrying on without us. But for the foreseeable future, it's human minds doing all this. But we so easily get caught into the myriad material world of things that when we try to look inside, we keep interpreting it in terms of the material world of things. So that's a little mapping out of some of the territory and some of the challenges of that territory. So I think it's a good time to offer another pretty basic but a little trickier Buddhist practice, one many of you are familiar with. But breathing, because it's a physical, tangible process, tends to be a bit more accessible than what I'm about to do. Anyway, let's give it a try. So please, again, get comfortable. Part of the thing, feet flat on the floor, very much like in the, on the Tai Chi CDs I saw in the case over there, by connecting in the earth with the earth, there's a grounding which, if we allow it to open up, creates a space where we're more sensitive and can be more alert. So the feet on the floor is the way to ground, connect, even though we're not going to focus on our feet, but it's a way to touch and ground. And from feet, feel your body sitting in the chair. And again, for a little while, just feel the body sitting here. Perhaps, as we feel the body sitting here, and especially in between my words, you might notice something called thinking. if there's any thinking happening, whether in pictures and images or more words and concepts, notice that there's thinking. If possible, don't get engrossed in the storyline, what it's about. Simply notice thinking. And if there are periods or pauses of no thinking, notice that. And by the way, it's not necessary to think about non-thinking, although you might be tempted. If there's thoughts, notice thinking. If no thinking, simply register. If there's a string of thoughts, notice that, like a freight train, there are little gaps between the thoughts, just as the boxcars have gaps. Might be easier to listen to that clock over there, or the hum somewhere else. Please keep coming back to thinking or not thinking. Not always easy to do. And you might also be thinking, why does it shut up so I can do it? Just notice thinking and not thinking. If if you like, open your eyes, I'll carry on with the more talk mode. But as I speak, feel free to continue noticing when there are thoughts. There might be moments of just listening, and then there'll be moments when thoughts are provoked or they come from something that happened earlier today or what you're going to do when this is over and so on. But I'll continue vocalizing my thoughts around today's topic. And I encourage you to both listen, but also notice thoughts arising, passing away. Thoughts are a good place to investigate mind. It's a little confusing if we say investigate heart, because our culture associates thoughts with intellect and mind and heart with emotion, feelings. One reason I like the word psyche, it doesn't separate the two, and which is the case in the languages of Buddhism. It's a relatively recent Western cultural phenomena going back to the so-called Enlightenment, when science and religion separated roughly the same time thought and emotion were separated. And then there were movements like rationalism and romanticism, which play out in different ways to this day. In the Buddhist word that gets translated mind is citta, and its root meaning is the same as the one of the roots for thinking. So there's in the background of Buddhist teaching, there's a connection between mind and thought. However, for the romantics in the room, and by the way, American Buddhism is heavily influenced by romanticism, sometimes more than Buddhism. There's an interesting book that just came out about that. In early Buddhist speak, or even the way my teacher spoke, thought includes emotion. It's just the limits of translation. The way we tend to separate thought and emotion, many Buddhist teachers don't. And so it's a little hard. So I'm going to stretch a few terms here and say, the root of the word mind, actually it's something, it also can mean to create, to give birth to thoughts and to emotions. So this is a good place to explore mind. Thoughts and emotions are relatively active compared to not thinking. And when there's not much or any emotion going on, such as in what's often spoken of, the silent mind, the quiet mind, there are a number of similar phrases. That silence is much more subtle, whereas relatively thought and emotion is pretty active. And therefore, it can be accessible. I know people that have trouble following their breath. And for them, noticing thoughts is a better starting place for meditation. It doesn't work that way for me. It took me a while to recognize and respect that, oh, for some people, this seems to be effective. We can call this mindfulness of thoughts. And this is linked with what's called contemplation of thought or mind, which means of emotion and heart as well. To pay attention to thoughts and emotions, and somewhat more subtly moods, which I'll come to in a little bit, we watch and begin to learn about a primary activity of mind. So part of the title tonight is related to the question, what is mind? But I don't want to get metaphysical about it, so I didn't ask it that way. But in Buddha's teaching, at one level, not the whole story, but a level of response to the question, what is mind? Mind thinks. Mind emotes. Thinking and emotion are activities of mind. I'm not going to take that apart theoretically. There are a lot of different perspectives. But practice-wise, okay, we're going to watch thought, watch emotions. Crucial to that is to not jump on the train, not get lost in the narrative. We love our stories. Generally because they're all about us. You know, or our grandkids, but that's us too. They're our grandkids. Or it could be your football team or the Walla Walla, the balloon thing. Not even balloon. You know, it's about us. Our little us, our bigger us, but it's us, it's me. So we like those stories. When we're caught in the stories, we don't learn too much about mind. We can learn some things. So part of the trick of being mindful of mind, awareness, thought, emotion, psyche, is leave the content alone. It doesn't mean try to push it away. That doesn't work. But notice when you're grabbing at the content, you're getting into it. You can tell you're getting more dramatic. You're getting more passionate. You might be getting upset. Your feelings hurt. You're angry. You bought into some content, the storyline. Could be a story about the past. It could be a story about the future, plans, fantasy, where you're going. You may never get there, but we still spend a lot of energy on those. Keep rehashing old stuff. Forget to actually live the present because we're pinging back and forth between past and future. So in a deeper mindfulness practice, we learn to notice thoughts, notice emotion, or if you like, creativity in a Buddhist sense, not the popular sense. Stuff being created in here. And that's a level of coming to terms with mind or psyche or awareness. And when I mentioned the gaps, this tends to be really helpful. When our awareness is fuzzy, it tends to blur together. That story about me seems to, you know, take on a solidity. And, you know, the me, part of the story about me is I was, I am, I will be. And there's even a strong human tendency to make that story about me forever. Somehow we think that'd be a great idea, that I'm going to last forever. I don't think people think very carefully about that. Most, we don't even have a clear idea what forever is. You know, it's, I know it's on Hallmark cards and stuff like that. But, you know, we have lots of ideas that aren't actually examined. So anyway, part of coming to terms with mind is not jumping on the thought or the train and then noticing gaps. And that starts to shift some of the assumptions don't hold up quite so well when we notice gaps. Thinking is a string of thoughts, ideas, images, memories, and emotions. And when we start to see gaps, we also start to notice how much this stuff changes. And that poses some questions about mind. One of the unexamined assumptions about mind is it's kind of the same mind. Especially when we think of the mind. But does that hold up if there are all these gaps? And then you notice how erratic it can be. And you meet, you know, you meet very rational people who are actually behaving irrationally about their rationalism, while denying that any such thing could be the case. Like, one of my favorite examples are atheists who get very angry about religion. What's rational about that? Fortunately, economics, at least parts of it, have started to get this, that economic players are not rational actors much of the time. Wall Street is seldom rational, and so on. And it's now obvious with politics. Anyway, I don't want to get off tangent. So those are another level of looking into mind.